strife is less than the span of an eye blink to them. Bernard's frown deepened as he took a clean cloth and began washing the First Lord's feet as gently as he could.
And Kolaris can control this thing?
Not even remotely, Gaius said. But he can annoy it, arousing its wrath, and he can delay its response for a time. When he ceases to do so, Kolaris will spend his wrath upon anyone it meets.
Kolaris? Amara asked. Like Mount Kolaris?
For which Kalare itself is named, Gaius said, nodding. Though it is not only a mountain, but an ancient fire mountain. It has not spoken in Ilaran memory, but Kolaris has stirred it up. When he dies, Kolaris will burst free of the mountains and bathe the land in fire.
He leaned forward, meeting Bernard's eyes, then Amara's, in turn.
If I let the legions besiege Kalare, it will mean more deaths fighting on the approach. It will mean that all of Kalaris's forces will have fallen back to the city. It means that an entire campaign's worth of refugees will have fallen back with them.
Bloody crows, Bernard breathed.
He means to make a bier of allies, enemies, and subjects alike, of the city itself. I can intercede, Gaius said, but only if I can physically approach to within a few miles and clear sight of Mount Kolaris.
He took a deep breath.
If I don't intervene, it will mean more lives senselessly lost to Kolaris's spite.
His eyes glittered, cold and hard.
I won't have it. Not in my realm.
So, Amara said quietly, the plan is to get you in close enough to deprive Kolaris of his funeral pyre?
The First Lord nodded.
I never truly understood how horrible life was in Kalare, how he had transformed his lands into a nightmare of slaves and fear. I failed his people. Now he threatens to burn them all alive. I will not allow them to die at the will of that madman.
Bernard looked up at the First Lord, his eyes steady.
Count Calderon, Gaius said calmly, please believe me when I say that I will proceed, either with you or through you.
Bernard regarded him without blinking. Then he said,
your feet are swollen, and those boots aren't going to fit. We'll need to let you rest for a day or so. And I'll try to make your footwear a little more comfortable before we move again.
He turned to Amara.
Can you find us a spot to camp, out of sight of the trail? There's no sense loitering here until someone stumbles into us.
Amara rose and went to Bernard's side. She touched his shoulder briefly and said, thank you.
Gaius exhaled slowly and bowed his head gently to the Count of Calderon. Aye, Bernard. Thank you.
Bernard glanced from Gaius to Amara, frowning, but he said nothing. Chapter 14.
This is outrageous, Maximus sputtered, his words oddly flat-sounding within the windcrafting that kept their conversation private.
His horse danced nervously at the fury in his voice.
We should hand the son of a bitch his head for suggesting such a thing.
Unfortunately, it isn't a suggestion, Crassus murmured.
Max's slender brother rode on Tavi's other side and was a good deal less ruffled.
It's an order.
Max's hand flew to the hilt of his sword.
I've got the proper response to that order right here.
Crassus cast his brother a resigned look and said,
you aren't helping.
Crassus is right, Max, Tavi said quietly. This isn't a problem we can hack to pieces.
Just you watch me, Max growled.
His horse half reared in response, one hoof striking out as if to crush some unseen foe. Actaeon snorted at these antics, but his pace never wavered, and Tavi was grateful that his mount did not seem inclined to the same spontaneous displays of physical prowess of most warhorses. Max calmed his horse with an expert's casual skill and said,
I'm not letting anyone kill those townies.
Tavi glanced over his shoulder where the prisoners were being walked out of Othos as ordered, surrounded by Valiar Marcus's prime cohort. Tavi had deliberately ordered a slow pace, but some of the elderly among the prisoners were having trouble even so. He caught Marcus's eye and flicked a signal at the first spear. Marcus slowed the pace even more. Just as well, Tavi thought. It would give him a little more time to figure a way out of this mess.
"We aren't going through with it," Max growled. "Right?"
Tavi shook his head slowly, more a gesture of irritation than anything else. "The children are clear, at least." Crassus frowned in thought, then glanced at Tavi.
"Age of accountability?"
"Exactly," Tavi said. Hoofbeats approached. Araris came trotting down the line of horses and offered a thick book to Tavi.
"What's that?" Max asked.
Tavi held up the book, titled simply, Military Law. Then he flipped it open and started searching for the proper reference. Crassus smiled.
"You came prepared, eh?"
"Gift from Cyril," Tavi replied.
"Age of what?" Max said.
"Accountability, you illiterate thug," Crassus said. He flashed a small smile at Max. "Legally speaking, a child under the age of 12 dwelling in an adult's household cannot be held accountable for most crimes. Their parent or guardian is responsible for their behavior."
"So that gets the kids out of trouble," Max said.
"It isn't enough," Tavi said. "It just means we'd have to execute their parents twice." He held up the book. "Arnus has to adhere to the letter of the law. As a legion commander in a war zone, he's got full authority to pass summary judgment on enemy troops and support personnel."
"With no trial?" Max asked.
"Not if they aren't citizens," Tavi said. "And Arnus is interpreting the definition of support personnel to include any Alaran who has cooperated with the Khanim in any fashion. He says the fact that they let those Khanim into their town makes them traitors."
"Against Nasorg's army? They had no choice," Max spat. "Look at them."
Crassus shook his head. "Legally speaking, they had a choice. They could have fought the Khanim and died.
That's suicide, but legal."
Crassus frowned at Tavi. "Captain, do you think the senator's sentence will stand up before a tribunal of review?"
"He isn't ordering the execution of any citizens," Tavi said, scanning pages in the book.
He found the proper section, and it confirmed his fears.
"Crows.
Technically, he's acting within the bounds of the law. So it will come down to politics," Max growled.
"If he's successful against the Khanim, his judgment will probably be supported."
"And if the campaign goes badly," Crassus said, "his enemies will use it to eviscerate his career."
Tavi ground his teeth.
"Not that it will matter to the people of Othos by then."
"There's got to be something we can do, Captain," Max protested.
Tavi grimaced. "If Arnos had put half as much planning into the assault on Othos as he had into this, he'd have taken the town without a man lost." He snapped the book shut rather harder than was necessary and looked at Max.
"Legally speaking, my only options are to carry out the order or resign."
"Which is what Arnos wants," Crassus said quietly. Tavi glanced aside at Crassus, surprised that he would bring up the point. The young knight commander had rather pointedly remained entirely silent during any conversation touching upon politics more than indirectly. It was hardly surprising, considering that Crassus's mother had betrayed them all at the Elenarch, and his uncle was leading a rebellion that had ground on for most of 2 years. His father, High Lord Antillus, commanded fully half the forces of the Shield Wall, the vast edifice that walled away the threat of the Icemen in the savage north, and was one of the most respected men in Alara. All in all, that made Antillus Crassus into a potential wildfire, politically speaking. Tavi had sent the First Lord strongly favorable reports regarding the young lord's skill, capability, and loyalty. If he hadn't, Gaius might well have made sure that a young man with such volatile potential was transferred to a less inflammable post. All of that,
meant that Crassus had tactfully remained aloof from the intrigue that touched upon the first Alaran, except where it directly affected his ability to perform his duties. It had not meant, however, that he had closed his eyes to what was happening, and Tavi's respect for Max's younger half-brother went up another notch.
"Which is probably what he wants," Tavi agreed quietly. "Either way, he's arguably within his rights, and I've got no legal recourse to refuse the order."
Max let out a chuckle with a hard edge on it. "Like you've ever let little things like laws get in the way." Tavi frowned. It was true enough, he supposed, but that was before he'd been made aware of the fact that he might be the one expected to uphold and defend those laws one day. Law was what separated civilization from barbarism. Law was what enabled a society to protect the weak from the strong who would abuse or destroy them. He looked over his shoulder at the poor people of Uthos. The law had been made to defend them, not to murder them.
"We might have to get creative," he said quietly.
He squinted up at the sky.
"What I wouldn't give for a storm right now."
Max gave Crassus a speculative look, but the young lord shook his head.
"Arnas lost some of his knight's heiress, but the rest of them would sense it if we tampered with the weather."
Tavi nodded. "We need to stretch this out until dark."
Max grunted.
"Why?"
"The Carnim like to operate at night. Once night has fallen, who knows? We might be attacked by a force of raiders, and in the confusion the prisoners might escape."
Max pursed his lips, then broke into a smile.
"Those crow-begotten Carnim ruin everything, Captain."
Crassus frowned.
"We'll be ordered to pursue them. There's no way that group could escape any competent pursuit."
"I know," Tavi replied. "We do it anyway."
Crassus rode in silence for a few pensive seconds.
"I'm with you, sir. But all you'll do is delay things by a day or so, at most. Then you'll be right back where you are now."
"A lot can change in a day or so," Tavi said quietly. "Either of you have a better idea?"
Neither spoke, and Tavi closed his eyes for a moment, ordering his thoughts.
"The first thing we need is time. We're going to double-check all of the prisoners' identities."
"Sir?"
Crassus said. "Arnas can't possibly fault me being careful to make sure we aren't subjecting a citizen to an injustice."
Crassus narrowed his eyes and began nodding.
"And he'll figure you're doing it to protect yourself from legal consequences, because that's why he'd do it."
Tavi nodded.
"Crassus, confirm their identities and be thorough.
Make it take until sundown. Go."
"Yes, sir," Crassus said.
The young commander banged a fist to his chest and turned his horse, nudging it into a rather listless trot toward the prisoners.
"Max," Tavi said, "get Schultz, and tell him to pick two spears of men who can keep their mouths shut. You'll take them and stage a raid tonight once it's full dark. Something noisy but not too spectacular, and leave a couple of the Carnim weapons we've recovered lying around. Arnas will have sent some men to keep an eye on things by then. Handle them, but don't kill anyone if you can possibly avoid it."
"Understood," Max said.
He lowered his voice and said, "Crassus is right, you know. The Senator will only send you after them and relieve you for incompetence when you don't bring them back and carry out the order."
"Let me worry about that, Max. Get moving. I'm going to send word to Cyril to find out if—"
"Captain," Araris interrupted.
Tavi glanced back at the Singulare, who nodded down the line. Tavi turned to see Kitai thundering up the column toward him, with Enna and a dozen Marat trailing her. As they slowed, Max released the wind crafting that surrounded them, saluted Tavi, and turned his horse to head back down the column. The Marat came to a halt in a blowing, disorderly clump all around them, as Kitai drew her horse up beside Tavi's, her lovely face expressionless. The Marat called to one another, trading what were apparently jibes and boasts in their own tongue. Several of the younger riders, as restless and energetic as their mounts, continued dancing in circles around the larger group, their horses shaking their heads and rearing from time to time. Tavi turned intent eyes to Kitai right away.
It might have looked sloppy and exuberant, but the Marat had long since worked out their own method to veil conversations from any windcrafters who might be attempting to listen from afar. Kitai's leg bumped against Tavi's as their horses walked, and he could sense the tension in her. They stretched out their hands to one another at the same time and briefly entwined their fingers.
"Chala," Kitai said, "I worried for you during the battle."
"You worried for me?" Tavi asked. He couldn't help but smile a little. "You were the one leading an attack on an enemy position."
Kitai sniffed. "That was nothing. I didn't get close enough to lift a blade."
She cast a general glower around them at the Marat of the Horse Clan. "They got there first."
"Still, it was well done."
She arched a pale eyebrow at him.
"Yes, of course it was."
Her haughty expression faltered, though, and she glanced around them, making sure that no one was close enough to overhear them through the cacophony of the Horse Clan.
"There is something you must see."
Tavi nodded at once, flashed a hand signal to the first spear, and turned his horse out of the slow column of marching men. Kitai's horse wheeled perfectly in time with his, and he supposed that an outsider looking on would have thought that he was leading her, and not the other way around. The Marat escort joined them as they cantered to the east and away from the column. They rode for most of 2 miles, by Tavi's estimate, the sharp rise of the bluff on their right, until they reached a small copse that had grown up where a burbling spring spilled water down from the higher ground. 2 Marat horses were grazing on fresh spring grass outside the trees. The little company rode up to the copse and dismounted. Tavi passed Actian's reins over to Enna and followed Kitai into the trees.
"We took a prisoner, Chala," she said without preamble, her pace never slowing. "An Alaran. A messenger."
Tavi hissed in sudden excitement.
"Yes? What did he say?"
"That he would speak only to you."
They brushed through a few yards of undersized evergreens that hid whatever was beyond them from view. When they emerged, Tavi found himself in a small clearing, where a pair of Marat warriors stood with bows in hand and arrows on strings, calmly regarding a man seated on the ground between them. Tavi blinked and lifted his eyebrows, recognizing the man, the rebel scout he'd subdued back at his aborted ambush of the Khanim column. The man was wearing the same clothes, minus all his gear, which had been placed in a neat pile several feet away from him. The scout glanced up at him and blinked twice before his own eyes widened in recognition.
"You," he said. "Bloody crows."
Tavi felt one corner of his mouth lift in a smile.
"Good afternoon," he said. "We've got to stop meeting like this."
The scout looked uncertain for a moment, then barked out a short laugh.
"I'm lord."
"I'm no lord," Tavi replied. "Rufus Scipio, captain of the 1st Alaran."
The man bowed his head slightly.
"Captain, my name is Jureus. I'm a centurion of the 1st Freehold Legion Auxiliaries."
"Freehold centurion?" Tavi asked.
"The capital city of Free Alara, captain."
He lifted his chin with a slight but undeniable glitter of defiance in his eyes.
"Our capital. The freeman's capital."
Tavi nodded.
"I see. I'm told you bear a message."
The man nodded and slipped a hand inside his tunic.
Both Marat drew their bows, and the deadly steel tips gleamed as they oriented on Jureus. In the same instant, Kitai's sword hissed from its sheath.
Jureus froze, his eyes very wide. He licked his lips, glancing back and forth between the weapons and Tavi.
"Slowly, centurion," Tavi said, keeping his voice calm. "You'll have to excuse my friends. We've had problems with more than one assassin, and they tend to err on the side of caution."
Jureus swallowed and, very slowly, withdrew a small bundle of cloth from beneath his tunic. He bowed his head and offered it out to Tavi on both of his upturned palms.
"Nasorg bade me give you this," he said quietly.
Kitai stalked forward and took the cloth, then returned with it to Tavi's side. Tavi frowned down at the cloth. It looked vaguely familiar. Then he realized what he was holding. A plain, worn tunic. Specifically, Aaron's tunic, the one he'd been wearing when Tavi had last seen him. Tavi's fingers trembled a little in their hurry to unfold the cloth, revealing the tunic's contents. Two ludus pieces resided within. One was a white legionare, the missing piece from his own set. The second was a knight of black stone from a much larger, less finely carved set. Tavi chewed on his lower lip and nodded absently to the Marat guards. They eased back on their bowstrings, relaxing once more, their expressions never changing.
"I recognize it," Tavi said quietly. "Did he send anything else with you?"
Jureus nodded.
"Nasog said to tell you that in most games this would be a poor trade, but that it is one he is willing to offer, provided you, and only you, come to speak to him."
Tavi frowned at the messenger.
"Where?
When?"
"Immediately, Captain," Jureus said. "He is nearby. I am to lead you to him."
"And if I refuse?"
Jureus smiled a little and spread his hands.
"Then Nasog will have exchanged a legionare for a knight, and profited thereby."
Tavi considered the pieces on Aaron's tunic for a moment.
"Nasog plays ludus well," he said.
"Surely he would think me a fool to sacrifice a first lord for the sake of a knight." "He offers you safe conduct, Captain."
Tavi folded the tunic back over the pieces.
"And what does he offer as a guarantee?"
Jureus regarded Tavi steadily.
"His word."
Tavi drew in a deep breath. This could very well be a trap. The Khanim were cunning and ruthless when it came to warfare. It was in fact a point of pride to them. In war there was no such thing as cheating, no rules, no mercy. Tavi had no doubt that Nasog would not hesitate to deny his enemy a valuable resource like Aaron, unless there was a greater gain to be had in keeping him alive. Simultaneously, though, the Khanim of the warrior caste seemed to adhere to a rigid standard of honor. They respected strength, courage, and skill, and Tavi had somehow managed to demonstrate all three during the first desperate days of battle at the Elenarch. Tavi clenched a fist in frustration. This wasn't merely an offer to parley. It was a test of his commitment to the concept. Nasog would not make a second offer, to say nothing of the fact that Aaron's life hung in the balance. Tavi could not afford to let this opportunity pass by, and Nasog knew it, which made it a perfect trap, which in turn made it a perfect test, which made it an opportunity he could not afford to... Tavi shook his head before the circular logic made him dizzy. He had to try.
"Challa,"
Kitai whispered, brushing her fingers against his arm.
"Are you sure?"
He turned to look her in the eye.
"No."
"But you'll go anyway."
"They have Aaron," he said.
She scowled at him, clearly unhappy with his response.
"This is foolish."
"Maybe," he agreed.
"Stubborn, proud, stupid."
She sighed and leaned forward to kiss him lightly on the mouth, her lips warm and sweet. She settled back again and said,
"I would hit you on the head with a rock and drag you away from this, but it would only shatter the rock."
Tavi gave her a quick, warm smile and turned to the captive scout.
"Very well, Centurion. Get your gear. Whatever happens, this ought to be an interesting conversation."
Chapter 15 Jureus set off at a quick pace, and the former slave's stocky body moved with surprising grace and speed over the open ground. If Tavi had not been mounted, he would barely have been able to keep the pace, despite having kept himself in training for overland marches beside his own men. As it was, Actaeon followed Jureus at a lazy canter, and the miles passed by. The bluff beside them gradually dwindled to a steep hillside, then blended into the gently rolling terrain of the vale. After about an hour, Jureus swerved to the right, leading Tavi into a young wood.
They passed through it and descended into a narrow ravine that Tavi could not even see until Jureus stepped into it. The ravine wound along an ancient stream bed, and the roots of trees dangled out of the rough earthen stone walls on either side of him. The path at the bottom of the ravine divided several times and finally ascended into an old-growth wood, completely enclosed by a canopy of fresh spring leaves. The earth was covered with low grasses, and those sparse enough. Shafts of sunlight peeked through the trees here and there, and the sound of the wind in the leaves was a constant murmuring susurrus. Nasorg was waiting for them. Tavi recognized the enormous black-furred Kane at once. Most of 9 feet tall, even in his hunched casual posture, the Kane wore armor of blood-red steel and bore an enormous slightly curved sword in a scabbard at his side. His ears flicked forward, orienting on Tavi and Jureus, and Tavi saw Nasorg's nostrils flare as he quested for their scents. Tavi took a moment to scan his surroundings. If he needed to flee suddenly, he wanted to know which direction offered him the best chance of evading pursuit. More to the point, he was sure that Nasorg was not the only Kane present. Tavi couldn't see them, but the wolf-like beings rarely operated in anything but groups. Tavi nudged Actaeon forward, and the horse snorted and tossed his head at the feral predator smell of the Kane. He sidestepped for a nervous second, but Tavi guided him forward with a light touch on the reins, and the battle-trained mount continued until they stopped perhaps 10 feet from Nasorg.
"Captain," Nasorg growled.
His voice was a deep, resonant thing, though his alarin was chewed and mangled by his fangs and jaws as he spoke it. He tilted his head slightly to the right.
"Nasorg," Tavi replied, mirroring the gesture. "Where's my man?"
The Kane's ears twitched in what Tavi recognized as a gesture of approval. Nasorg growled something under his breath, and another Kane, smaller, his fur grizzled and thick with scars, appeared from around the trunk of the tree, leading Aaron with him. The cursor's wrists were bound with leather straps. His shirt was smeared with grime, and there were dark circles under his eyes, but other than that, he seemed whole. Tavi reached into a pocket and withdrew the black ludus piece Nasorg had sent. He tossed it to the Kanem leader, who caught it with a casual flick of one paw-like hand. Nasorg nodded to Tavi and growled something else. The older Kane drew a knife from his belt, and Tavi felt himself tense up. His concerns were groundless. The knife parted Aaron's bonds, and then the old Kane returned it to its sheath.
"Go to your captain," Nasorg growled.
Aaron eyed him warily, but walked quickly over to stand beside Tavi. "You all right?" Tavi asked. "Mostly embarrassed," Aaron said. "They caught me before I could approach them openly." Tavi nodded, drew his knife from his belt, and offered the hilt to Aaron. The cursor took it with a nod of thanks and promptly turned to watch their backs.
"You return a scout to me,"
Nasorg growled.
"I return one to you. The scales between us are balanced."
"Agreed," Tavi said. "Your troops fought well today."
"We do what we must,"
Nasorg replied.
"Why do you wish to speak with me?"
"To discuss a solution to our problems."
"Problems,"
Nasorg said. A bubbling snarl that was the Kanem equivalent of a chuckle vibrated through the word.
"Of which problem do you speak?"
"I have come to believe that our peoples are dying needlessly," Tavi replied. "This war profits neither your realm nor mine."
"We fight for our lives, Captain,"
Nasorg growled.
"Another day is profit enough for me."
"And we fight to defend against an invader," Tavi replied. "We both have motivation in plenty to wage a war. But it is my hope that there is mutual advantage to be gained by peace." Nasorg's gleaming black eyes narrowed, and his ears remained perfectly still, focused on Tavi.
"Explain."
"I want you to leave Alera," Tavi said. "But it makes no difference to me how you go, so long as you are gone."
He gave Nasorg a small smile, showing a few teeth. We both know that you can't hold out forever. Even if you defeat these legions, others will be raised and sent against you. And still others will be, should they fall. You're too badly outnumbered, and you know it. Sooner or later, Alera will grind you into dust. Nasorg's chest rumbled with a warning growl, but he said nothing to contradict Tavi's statement.
I will not surrender to your kind.
I would never ask it of you, Tavi replied.
What then?
Tell me how long it will take you to finish your ships. Nasorg's lips peeled back from his teeth in surprise. He growled something in Carnish that Tavi didn't catch before saying,
Longer than I would prefer.
My new commander believes you intend to employ them against Alera.
Ships carry troops, Nasorg said. I don't need them to take my troops to Alera. They are already here.
You want to go home, Tavi said quietly. Nasorg was silent for most of a minute before he answered Tavi, his rumbling voice barely audible.
Yes.
In other words, Tavi said, I want you gone, and you want to leave. It seems to me that we are each in a position to solve the other's problem.
In a rational world, perhaps, Nasorg said. But we are in Alera.
Tavi nodded. We are. Because Saul led your people here.
Saul!
Nasorg's voice rumbled with harsh rage, and one of his feet flicked backward, scattering dirt and old leaves.
He was a coward and a fool.
You never truly supported him, Tavi said. That's why he burned your ships behind you. Nasorg said nothing. Why? Tavi asked him. Why did you follow him here?
He had the proper authority. I had orders. It was my duty to follow them, no matter how insane they might seem.
I understand, Tavi said, unable to stop a wry note from entering his voice.
And he had...
Nasorg let out a growl of frustration.
There is no Alaran word. He had charge of many warrior caste families.
Hostages? Nasorg made a small slashing motion with one poor hand.
Not the same.
Tavi frowned. But Saul does not command you now.
No,
Nasorg said. Given the chance, would you depart peacefully? The Carne tilted his head to one side, eyes narrowing.
Your forces have begun a war season against us. They do not seek a peace.
What if that changed? Tavi asked. What if the First Lord ordered them to go no further? Would you be willing to withdraw your support from High Lord Kalaris and enter a truce until your departure? Again the Carne entered a pensive silence. Tavi pressed him. There has to be a reason Saul did what he did, Nasorg. He loaded every boat he could find with every Carne he could find and sailed them across the full breadth of the sea to land here. He was a coward, and we both know it. He was running from something, wasn't he? Nasorg remained still. If he was running from what I think he was, Tavi said quietly, then you and your men are badly needed at home. The legions are coming for Mastings, Nasorg. If they take it, they will burn your ships and any hope you have of returning home. Even if they don't take it, this time they will bleed your ranks, attack your supply lines, and hinder your shipwrights in every way they can imagine. He leaned forward, meeting the Kane's eyes. The fastest way for you to get home with the strongest possible force is to agree to this truce. Tavi settled slowly back in his saddle and watched Nasorg, waiting.
Captain,
he said after a time.
You are Gadara, but not all Alarans are.
Gadara? Tavi said, frowning. Enemy? Nasorg made another slashing negative gesture.
Not the same. You have my respect, but you do not lead them. You do not speak in the voice of Gaius Sextus. and your people have proven to us many times that they are not worthy of trust.
Tavi frowned. How so?
Because you are monsters,
Nasorg replied, his tone implying that he was stating the perfectly obvious.
You are worse than starving beasts. You slaughter one another by the thousands over matters of leadership. Your people crush those without power and take whatsoever they wish from them for the simple reason that they can.
The Carne's muzzle lifted in a gesture of contempt.
You betray, enslave, and brutalize your own kind, Aleran. Your own. If you treat your own folk this way, what fool could possibly believe you would act any differently toward mine?
Tavi felt himself rock back a little at the vehemence in Nasorg's voice. He had never really considered things from that point of view. Slavery, of course, had been a problem for years. It would likely continue to be one for years more. The fury-crafting-based system of citizenship, title, and privilege was utterly inflexible, and how well he had known the futility of laboring beneath it. Nasorg continued,
"We came upon those you had enslaved and set them free. And because we had done it, when they sought arms to defend that freedom, we supported them. But I know, and you know, that your legions will not rest until they have been destroyed, for seizing what by rights should belong to all."
"That is the way of some Alarans," Tavi replied. "It is not my way, nor the way of my lord, Gaius Sextus."
"Perhaps not, Gradara," Nasorg said. "But words are nothing but air."
"Unless they are followed by action," Tavi countered. "I am here only because you gave me your word."
"I have shown you my word is good,"
Nasorg said. "Then let me show you the same of mine," Tavi said.
"How?"
"What would you consider sufficient action?" Nasorg let out a thoughtful, rumbling growl.
"One whose word I trust over my own was once a guest of honor in your land. I am told that he is held prisoner in some stinking house of stone in Alere Imperia."
"You mean Varg," Tavi said. "Yes, he is held prisoner."
"Varg did not behave dishonorably."
"How do you know that?" Tavi asked. Nasorg flexed one poor hand, extending his claws.
"He is Varg."
Tavi was silent for a moment, then nodded. "He did not behave with dishonor. Quite the opposite. He warned us of the coming of a foe called the Vord."
"And he rots in a prison because of it,"
Nasorg snarled, baring his fangs.
"Your word may be good, Captain. Perhaps we can make an arrangement whereby I can leave your haunted land peacefully. But it will not happen without Varg."
Tavi glanced down at Aaron, who shot a nervous glance up at him.
"If I bring you Varg," Tavi said quietly, "will you be willing to withdraw your strength from Kalaris? To draw back to Mastings, build your ships, and depart this land?"
Nasor glanced aside at the grizzled old Carne beside him. Neither of them said anything or moved, but Tavi felt sure they had communicated with one another nonetheless. Nasorg turned back to Tavi and nodded once.
"Yes, but this agreement will have no bearing on how I wage war against you. Until I see Varg and speak to him face to face, your legions will pay in blood for every step of ground they wish to take."
"I understand," Tavi said quietly. "If it can be done, it will take some time." Nasorg nodded.
"Then until that time, Gavar, we will seek one another's throats."
His fangs shone again.
"Go from this place."
He raised his voice and called in Carnish,
"Do not touch him!"
"Aaron," Tavi said quietly, mount up behind me. He leaned down and gave the cursor an arm up, and Aaron scrambled up onto the saddle behind Tavi. Tavi exchanged an Alaran-style nod with Nasorg, and then turned Actian and rode calmly and quietly from the clearing. He passed Jureus, who also nodded up at him, and then they moved steadily away. Half an hour later, as they came out onto ground Tavi recognized, he let out a slow breath and pressed Actian into a swifter pace over open plain.
"You came here alone?" Aaron demanded. "Are you insane?"
Tavi flashed a grin back at his friend.
"You're welcome."
Aaron shook his head.
"I really feel I should point out that there's no way you're going to get them to release Varg."
"But Gaius can," Tavi replied. "He'll see the sense of it at once."
"If you can reach him, maybe," Aaron replied. "What if you can't?"
Tavi opened his mouth to give Aaron a sharp-edged retort, and was cut off by a sudden blast of furious wind. Actian reared and skittered wildly to one side as a sudden gale threw up dirt and dust, blinding them all and deafening them with its roar. Actian lunged and bucked, panicking, and Tavi lost his seat, crashing to the ground beside Aaron. Tavi had to squeeze his eyes almost entirely shut, but he could just barely see the gleaming forms of Knight's Heiress descending around them, along with an 8-harness air coach. The coach landed, its bearers settling it to the ground, and one of them hurried to open the door. Phrygiana Varus emerged from the coach, slender in black, her face set in an odd little smile. Behind her, the rest of the senator's singulares also appeared, to be followed finally by the senator himself. Arnos, still in his silk robes, walked calmly over to them, flanked by his bodyguards. He stood over Tavi for a moment, a chilly little smile of satisfaction on his face.
"And now we know how your supposedly gallant legion managed to survive for so long against so many Khanum," he said quietly. "You've been conspiring with them the whole while, Scipio."
"That isn't true," Tavi snarled, "and you know it."
Arno swept his hand around at the circle of Knight's Heiress.
"I know no such thing. You were seen meeting with one of the Khanum officers, and I have better than a dozen witnesses who will attest to it. Furthermore, you were engaging in parley with the enemy against my express orders to avoid giving any impression of weakness or lack of resolve on our part."
Arnas lifted his chin, staring down at Tavi.
"It gives me no pleasure to do this, Rufus Scipio, but I place you under arrest for refusing to follow a direct order of your superior officer in time of war. You will be taken to the nearest stockade and held there until such time as a military tribunal can be assembled for your trial."
Tavi just stared at Arnas, shocked by what he was hearing, cursing himself for being careless. He'd warned Max that Arnas would have had watchers in place by that evening. He should have been smart enough to realize that Arnas already had him under surveillance, probably by several of his knight's heiress, hidden behind crafted veils. He'd taken a chance and gotten burned. He'd failed.
"Navaris," Arnas said, "take the prisoner into custody."
An unmistakable glitter of malice danced across his eyes.
"Find some place to lock him away until we can find time to try him for treason."
Chapter 16. Valiar Marcus glared at the young mother who had approached them from the group of prisoners. She had spotted his distinctive centurion's helmet with its scarlet crest, or the baton he carried in his hand as a symbol of his rank, and she walked over to him, trailing a young legionare. The plainly dressed woman had evidently overwhelmed the young man via sheer force of personality, and he gave Marcus a half-shamed, half-pleading look as he hurried to keep up with her.
"Centurion," she said.
She made part of a curtsy, likely the best she could do while carrying her young daughter on one hip. The child was silent, her blue eyes very wide.
"No one will speak to us. No one will tell us when we may return to our homes."
Marcus kept the glare going for a few moments, but it was a forlorn hope. The young mother was not going to be dissuaded.
"Ma'am," Marcus said,
I'm going to have to ask you to return to your place with the other prisoners.
I'm not going anywhere until I get some answers, she said quietly.
Yes, ma'am, you are, Marcus said. It's safest for you there.
The woman clenched her jaw in frustration. I don't understand what else you need from us, Centurion. None of us are armed or bore arms against the legions. None of us know anything that you didn't find out hours ago. There's no reason for us to be sitting here, even if that nice young man is being so painstaking in asking about our citizenship. Her voice trailed off, and her face set in a pensive frown, then in a sudden sick mask of fear. Marcus felt his knuckles tightening on the baton in frustration, and only a whisper of cracking wood let him realize that he had inadvertently summoned fury-born strength to his limbs. He'd seen that look on other women, in other places, and he hated it.
Ma'am,
Marcus said quietly. He pointed at the prisoners with his baton.
Go sit down. Now.
She stared blankly at him for a moment. Then she took a swift breath and said, My name is Estellus. Her arms tightened on her child. This is my daughter, Astara. Marcus turned his face away sharply at the words. Crows take it. He didn't want to know the woman or her name. Or, great furies help him, the name of her child. Their death warrant had already been signed. And it was his fault it had been. Their blood was going to be on his hands. Perhaps literally. He did not want to know their names. Some part of him could feel nothing but contempt for his own dismay. It had been his suggestion, after all, that the senator order the captain to kill another Alaran. He had assumed that Arnus would seize upon the opportunity to do so as soon as prisoners were taken from the legion of rebel slaves. He had assumed that the order would descend upon, at most, one or two score of enemy soldiers. It would have been a point of principle that he did not think the captain would have been willing to compromise. Marcus forced himself to turn his face back to Estellus and her daughter Astara, and to look past them at the hundreds of freemen of Othos. Dozens of families, women, children, elderly. How could Arnus have considered such a monstrous course?
Because you told him to do it, fool.
The young woman. Estellus stared at him, her face pale. She did not allow herself to weep, doubtless for the sake of her daughter, who clung sleepily to her side, but her eyes shone with the effort.
Sir, she said quietly.
The children are hungry.
Crows take Arnus, Marcus thought viciously. Crows take him and eat him whole.
There was still some hope. Antillus Crassus was taking his time about verifying each prisoner's lack of citizenship. Marcus might not have noticed it if he hadn't been working with the young man for the past 2 years, but it smelled like the young tribune was stalling. Crassus wouldn't be doing that on his own initiative. He was dutiful nearly to the point of insanity and always worked with quiet, industrious efficiency. So, unless he had suddenly decided to start dragging his feet, he was still attending to his duty. So, the captain was up to something. Marcus did not know what he intended. Legally speaking, he had only two options, but the young man had a talent for discovering previously unnoticed avenues of action. Perhaps he could do it again. Please let him do it again. Marcus was already steeped in blood. Much more, and he would drown. He kept his expression colder and harder than stone. If the prisoners went into a panic, great furies only knew what might happen.
Ma'am, he said.
He began to repeat his order, but instead he found himself meeting the gaze of little Astara. His breath left him in a long, slow exhalation.
Estellus, he said quietly. I assure you that my captain is doing everything he can to get you back to your homes as soon as possible. But until that time you are on the front lines of a war, around men who have seen hard battle today. For your own safety you need to return to the others.
He considered the little girl again and said,
I'll see what can be done about food. The young woman stared at him, straining, Marcus knew, to discern if he was telling her the truth or simply lying to her and sending her back to await slaughter like some foolishly wayward cow. She needn't have bothered. Even if she'd had an enormous amount of talent and practice at the watercrafter's art of truth-finding, he could have told her that the sky was green with perfect conviction.
Very well, Centurion.
She dipped into another awkward curtsy. Thank you.
Legionare,
Marcus growled. The young Legionare came to attention.
Sir, please escort Mistress Estellus and her daughter back to the others.
He nodded to her.
Ma'am.
The woman gave Marcus one last uncertain glance as she turned, then walked with the young Legionare back to where the prisoners sat. A veteran Legionare, though to be fair, any of the fish who'd come this far with the first Alaran deserved to be called veterans, named Bortus, leaned slightly toward Marcus.
Centurion, what are we going to do with these people?
Keep your teeth together, Bortus.
When I know, you'll know.
Marcus watched Estellus and Astara sit down again and grimaced. Whatever he was going to do, the captain had best hurry. Chapter 17 Tavi sat silently in Arnas's wind coach, cursing his own stupidity. He should have known better than to proceed upon such a potentially incriminating rendezvous when he might have been under aerial surveillance. Of course, there had been little enough he could have done under the circumstances. His own knight's heiress, weary from the exertions of the morning's battle, had not been at hand, and they were really the only way he might have reasonably known about being observed from high above. Even if they had been at hand, of course, he had moved away from any potential support to meet with Nasorg. He began to berate himself instead for his inexcusably bad judgment in doing so, but the potential to reach some other outcome than outright war with the Khanim had demanded that he take the risk. Perhaps it was neither stupidity nor poor judgment, but simply an unfavorable conjunction of opportunity, chance, and human will that allowed for no particularly desirable outcome, from his point of view at least. It had certainly been a fortunate enough morning for Arnos. It could have been worse. Aaron had not been recognized as anyone other than a local freeman. Had Arnas known he was a cursor of the crown and accorded the rank and privileges of a knight as a result, Tavi suspected that he would not have been allowed to live to bear testimony about what had happened. Instead, he had been bound, tossed on the luggage rack atop the coach, and was to be dropped with the condemned prisoners back at Othos. Assuming Aaron came out of the situation alive, he should prove to be a major lever in any tribunal examining Arnas's charge of treason. All Tavi needed to do was claim he was engaged in a prisoner exchange for a critically placed agent of the crown, which had the considerable merit of being entirely true. It would be pleasant to be able to throw that into Arnas's teeth, but Tavi refrained, lest Aaron accidentally tumble from the coach during flight. So he regarded the senator's detached expression of feline smugness with a blank face and said nothing. Instead, he sat, missing the presence of his sword far more acutely than he ever had before he'd begun feeling his way through metal crafting. It currently resided across the lap of Phrygia Navaris, who sat beside Arnos and stared at Tavi, her serpentine eyes never seeming to blink. The archer sat on Arnos's other side, and the largest of the two men in his retinue of singulares sat on either side of him.
"This is probably for the best, Scipio," Arnos said. "It was going to happen, one way or another. This way has the advantage of being relatively civilized."
Tavi didn't bother to answer. The galling thing was that to a certain extent Arnos was probably correct. Tavi wondered if Gaius had known just how ruthless the man was going to be when it came to removing any possible challenge to his authority. Arnas had been willing to see hundreds of innocent people die to remove Tavi. He certainly wouldn't have hesitated to strike out at anyone who supported Tavi against him. Tavi narrowed his eyes in thought. There might be one who he would be slow to oppose. In fact, this entire situation did not have to be a disaster. What was it old Killian had told the curses in training so often? Every problem was an opportunity, from the proper point of view. Arnas tilted his head and studied Tavi through narrowed eyes.
"What was that thought that just went by your eyes, Scipio? I don't think I liked the look of it."
Tavi smiled at him. Then he said, "Senator, men like you need never seek out their enemies. You create them left and right by virtue of drawing breath." Arnas made a clucking sound in his throat.
"You can't possibly think I am intimidated by your contacts. We all have powerful friends here."
"I don't think you can see far enough to realize what you should fear," Tavi replied.
"Crow-begotten shame, really. You have gifts. You could do a lot of people a lot of good if you so chose."
The senator's eyes went flat.
"If I so chose, Scipio," he said quietly, "I could have Navaris spill out your entrails here and now."
Tavi shook his head and nodded at the coach's window.
"If you'll look beneath you, Senator, I'm fairly sure that you'll see a picket line of riders below us, close enough to be within sight of one another and relay signals back to the camp. I ordered them not to accompany me to my meeting, which means that they followed me just far enough back to stay out of sight. They saw your men take me, I'm quite sure. Individually they aren't faster than a wind coach, but working together in good light on a clear day like this one, they can send word even faster. Odds are excellent that the camp already knows you've arrested me."
The senator narrowed his eyes. Then he turned aside and muttered something to the archer. She, in turn, opened a window on the roar of the windstream outside. She flagged down one of the accompanying knight's heiress. They had a brief exchange of hand signals. The knight vanished from the window and appeared again a moment later, flickering an affirmative signal at the archer. Arnas pressed his lips together and waited for the archer to shut the window again.
"Kill me if you like, Senator," Tavi said, before Arnas could speak. "But you might find yourself faced with quite a few awkward questions."
He leaned forward.
"And I am not some freeman whose death might be easily ignored."
Navaris's hand dropped to the hilt of Tavi's gladius, and her lips split in a snarl. Arna seized Navaris's sword wrist in one hand, his eyes locked on Tavi's.
"Now, now, good lady, let us not lose our tempers. It has been a trying day for all of us."
He smiled a little.
"Granted, only one of us is to be tried for treason."
"We'll see," Tavi said.
"We will most certainly see you tried and hung, Scipio," Arnas said.
This time there was no posturing in his voice, no overt grandstanding in his manner, almost no inflection on his words.
"Even if events conspire to clear you in the long run, your role in history is ended. Your legion will be led by another. You will play no role in this campaign. You will gain no power, no renown, during the most vital series of battles for 500 years, while others rise to power instead. Your reputation will be tainted regardless of the outcome of the tribunal. After the shadow of treason has fallen upon you, you won't be trusted to command a squad in a civic legion, and we both know it."
Tavi sat quietly.
It was worse, this calm delivery of fact, than any of Arnas's previous sneers and glowers.
He bowed his head before it the way a man might when faced with the inevitable cold of winter's first wind.
"You are already dead," Arnas said. "Dead enough to be of no more use to your patron. Dead enough to be no more threat to me."
He glanced away from Tavi as if he was suddenly no longer significant enough to notice.
"You're dead, Scipio. It is over."
The wind coach tilted as it began to descend, back to the guard-occupied walls of Othos.
"From here," Arnas said, "we can proceed in an agreeable, civilized manner, or we can do it the hard way. May I take it that you will cooperate? It will make things much easier upon your men."
Tavi didn't look up. He simply said,
"Very well."
"You see, Navaris?" Arnas murmured. "He can be reasoned with."
Tavi sat quietly and left his head bowed. It made it easier to conceal the smile. The coach landed in the Othos town square, now standing empty of anyone but legionaries of the guard. As Tavi